and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the production line killings being carried out by the state of Arkansas, with 8 men scheduled to be put to death in 11 days because suppliers of drugs used for lethal injections will only allow their products to be used for medically approved purposes. So the state's executioners, who are short on supply, had to drive to an undisclosed location to make a drug deal with an unnamed dealer who made no record of the sale. The president of Death Penalty Focus, Mike Farrell, a political and social activist best known for his roles in MASH and Providence, joins us to discuss the unseemly rush to kill, which resulted in Justice Gorsuch casting his first vote on the Supreme Court to put a likely innocent man to death, even though Liddell Lee is mentally incapacitated, DNA evidence was never tested, his defense was grossly incompetent, and the judge who sentenced him was having an affair with the prosecutor. Then we'll go to Istanbul, Turkey, to speak with Ronald Suni, an historian at the University of Michigan and a professor emeritus of political science and history at the University of Chicago, the author of They Can Live in the Desert But Nowhere Else, A History of the Armenian Genocide. He joins us to discuss the local reaction to the 102nd anniversary of the Armenian Genocide and how the educated and urban half of Turkey, who voted against President Erdogan's recent power grab, feel about Donald Trump's endorsement of their new dictator. Then finally, we will speak with the Turkish scholar who is considered the Sherlock Holmes of the Armenian Genocide, Tana Akçam, who holds the chair of Armenian Genocide Studies at Clark University and is the author of The Young Turks' Crime Against Humanity, joins us to discuss how he found documentation, the smoking gun, that proves the genocide against the Armenians that the Turkish government persists in denying took place. And joining us now is Mike Farrell, a political and social activist, best known for his portrayal of B.J. Honeycutt in the TV series MASH and Jim Hansen in the NBC series Providence. He is the president of Death Penalty Focus, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the abolition of capital punishment through grassroots organizing, research, and the dissemination of information about the death penalty and its alternatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Farrell.
Nice to be with you, and thanks.
Well, thanks, Mike. And it does seem extraordinary that you have a kind of production line going on down there in Arkansas, where the governor has basically scheduled 8 executions in 11 days, one of which has taken place because on Thursday the Supreme Court reversed a judge's order blocking the state's use of a lethal injection drug, and that was, of course, ended up being the first vote of the new Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch voting in favor of the execution, which they just got in under the wire, literally within a minute of the order expiring. So there's something unbelievably kind of arbitrary and gruesome and grim about this, which in his dissent, Justice Breyer on the Supreme Court really, I think, eloquently described. So for an advocate to get rid of the death penalty, which every other country in the world, except the really horrible ones, has long ago abandoned, how are you feeling at the moment?
Well, it's hideous. I said it was nice to talk to you, but it's never nice to have to acknowledge how low we have sunk. You've said pretty much the important bases to touch on with this case. It starts out with this asinine situation that the governor of Arkansas made a determination to kill 8 men, 4 of whom are black, in an expedited manner, in a kind of an assembly line manner, 2 a day was his initial plan, before the end of April, because he feared the drug that they would need to, under normal circumstances, if you can call it that, to one of the 3 drugs they'd need to carry out the 3-drug protocol to kill them, was to reached its expiration date at the end of the month, and they were afraid they wouldn't be able to get any more. So, let's hurry up and kill 8 people. So it is, as you have suggested, it's caused a kind of firestorm of confusion and opposition across the country. But in fact, some heroic work has been done by Scott Braden and the federal public defenders, as well as the specific lawyers who are handling each of the cases for these people. But you're talking about people who are potentially innocent, people whose cases have been prejudiced by inappropriate behavior on the part of a judge, people who are mentally, possibly mentally deficient. All of these questions that have arisen around these cases have not been fully resolved, and yet there was this determination to rush to not only judgment, but rush to execution on the parts of these people. Four of them, I think, effectively have been stopped by various courts that have said, in a couple of cases, there's some mental competence issues that have to be determined. One case has yet to be determined about it through a DNA test about actual innocence. But Liddell Lee, who was killed already, the first one to die, also had questions of actual innocence, and one, I think, quite extraordinary question about his trial. And, you know, what we're seeing is what Justice Breyer responded to as being indicative of a kind of the randomness of the application of the death penalty and the arbitrariness. I think it's a shame on Arkansas, it's a shame on the United States, and it's really a hideous set of circumstances that we face here.
Well, of course, always the idea of the state killing somebody undermines the moral authority of the state, and particularly abuses the rights of many, or if not the majority, of the people in that state that disapprove of the state acting in their name in such a barbaric manner. And as we know, the death penalty was abolished here in the United States up until recently. Then it came back in the early 1970s, I think it was. So in this case, though, it's not just the state having blood on its hands. The state in this case, the state of Arkansas, is acting like a back alley drug dealer. One of the drugs that potassium chloride that the maker, the drug maker Fresenius, refused to allow it to be used because they've forbidden it to be used for anything but medical purposes. The state ran out of this drug. So state correction officials in Arkansas accepted a donation of the drug by driving to an undisclosed location to meet an unnamed seller, just like a back alley drug deal. And as I mentioned in the beginning, the other drug, mercurium bromide, was the source of the stay that the Supreme Court overturned in the first vote that Judge Gorsuch took. So this is really about, it's about drug abuse as well as state murder.
Well put. And to add to that, if what I read is correct, when the deal was made, when the back alley transfer of drugs was made, the individual who provided it was asked to sign something showing that the state had received it, and he refused. I mean, it's really a hideous demonstration of how low the authorities are willing to go in this country to fulfill what they see as their proof of how tough they are on crime.
And again, I'm speaking with Mike Farrell, who's a political and social activist best known for his portrayal of B.J. Honeycutt in the TV series MASH and Jim Henson in the NBC series Providence. He is the president of Death Penalty Focus, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the abolition of capital punishment through grassroots organizing, research, and the dissemination of information about the death penalty and its alternatives. Let's just focus for a while, Mark, if we can, on Liddell Lee, who was murdered by the state of Arkansas last Thursday. First of all, he was born with the fetal alcohol syndrome disorder, which made him intellectually deficient. His story, the trials, and his legal representation is an absolute tragedy of an unbroken chain of drunk, incompetent, and conflicted attorneys. The crime scene was drenched in blood, but the state witness who put Liddell at the scene said he didn't have any blood on him. None of the forensic evidence was tested. They still weren't able to get a DNA testing for decades. And the worst part of it is that the judge in the case was having an affair with the prosecutor, who he eventually married, I suppose, That doesn't exonerate him, though, does it?
Certainly doesn't. No. You know, Nina Morrison, one of the primary attorneys at the Innocence Project, was representing Liddell. And she was insisting that he deserved at least a DNA test that could determine his innocence because, as you suggested, there was none of the blood from the scene was on him, but there was plenty of blood at the scene, which would have indicated that the possibility, at least, that it would show that he was involved, and they refused to do it.
So what explains that, though? I mean, I don't know whether you saw 60 Minutes on Sunday night, Mike Farrell, but a very conservative judge on the Ninth Circuit, Kaczynski, they did a profile on him, and he's been on a kind of tear about prosecutorial malpractice, and he's made that a real issue. And he made the point. He said, you know, you've got 2.2 million people in American jails. So if 1% of them are innocent, which is probably a lowball figure, that's 22,000 people. So this is, you know, that's bad enough. But if you start killing innocent people, that's a whole other story.
It is indeed, and it's not the function of starting killing innocent people. We've been killing innocent people ever since we've had this system, and that is pretty clearly known. I had actually a conversation with Judge Kaczynski, who is an apologist for, and I suppose one could say advocate for, the death system, but is, as you suggest, unfailingly critical of the way in which prosecutors abuse the system and in the way in which the ADPA, the Effective Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, gifted us by President Bill Clinton, carries forward, it has shortened the procedures, the possibility for the procedures that do protect the lives of these individuals who are accused of this terrible crime. We've already exonerated over 150, closing in on 160 men and women who have been tried, convicted, and sentenced to death in this country, only to be ultimately found out that they were innocent. But what we haven't taken into account, is the number of people that we have actually killed, that indications, we can't say facts, in some instances we can probably point to some facts, but certainly very, very strong indications are that they were innocent at the time they were executed. And the fact that the states won't admit to the having killed innocent people attests to the vulnerability the authorities feel about this this system. They're afraid they'll be sued and deserve to be sued and shamed for having done this.
Well, it does look as though these two other prisoners down in Arkansas will be executed tonight. And probably by the time we get off the air, it will be done. And that will be Jack Jones and Marcel Williams. And the Liddell Lee killing last Thursday, of course, was the first use of capital punishment since 2005 in Arkansas. What's the political reason here? Why is Governor Asa Hutchinson on this sort of jihad, do you know?
You know, I can't figure that out. I don't know if he's up for re-election or wants to go back to Congress or what his plans, hopes, and dreams are. But the fact is, at least two lives, and as you've suggested, two more tonight are being sacrificed on the basis of his political agenda, and it's really a disgusting thing.
And what is the possibility of, I mean, we're an outlier in so many ways now with the rest of the world, particularly with a president who is extremely unpopular, and around the world, most world leaders, particularly allies, are pretty appalled at what's happening. And he doesn't seem to care about what anybody thinks about him. He seems immune, but he keeps sort of appealing to his base. And admittedly, he does seem to still, in spite of his apparent incompetence, does have a tremendous support amongst his base.
It does.
What do you think can happen in terms of, you know, it's like so many things you wish that somehow the American people could be told about how other people around the world do things better, because we assume that we're the best at everything. We don't, for example, right next door, people in Canada have a better healthcare system and their drugs costs are infinitesimal compared to ours.
Yes.
But somehow that barrier can't be reached, you know. In other words, is there any way that the rest of the world can say, wait a minute, we got rid of this insanity a long time ago, and frankly, we find it appalling that this country, the United States, which we so admire for so many reasons, is an outlier along with Saudi Arabia and Iran and China and other despotic regimes. So what's going on?
Yeah. Well, you, as your question implies, of course, Mr. Trump is not interested in hearing from the rest of the world, nor, unfortunately, are a significant number of the people in this country, because we've all been so poisoned with this idea that we are the exceptional nation, the nation that must be recognized as the leader and can do no wrong, while immediately, and we are apprised of the fact that we are doing terrible, terrible wrongs. You know, if I may just make an editorial comment, Ian, I would disagree with your assessment. I don't think Mr. Trump doesn't care what other people think. I think he doesn't understand what other people think. I think he lives in a deluded state that it seems to indicate he believes that what he's doing is not only correct, but is being applauded by everybody but the most deranged of us. And there seem to be a growing number of those who would fall into the category, from his perspective, of being deranged.
Well, he and his attorney general, though, are trying to create an alternative reality by saying that the country is beset by crime, the inner cities are unlivable, that there's carnage throughout America, that we have to build a wall to keep the hordes out. None of this stuff is true.
No.
So when you have the situation down in Arkansas that we're talking about, the reason I bring up Trump, I don't want to keep bashing him unnecessarily, but he is the president of the United States. He's setting the kind of tone. And, you know, this just feels like a part of this overall delusion that crime is on the rise, which it is not, that we are under siege, which we are not, that there are enemies within, which is not the case, and that we have to wall ourselves off from the outside world. And all the while, there is a real danger out there that we're not even looking at, which is global warming.
Yes,
so we're afflicted by all these false fears. So I don't know how we get around this pricking the bubble of this paranoia that's being generated in this cynical way by people like Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions.
Well, I couldn't agree more. It is terribly, terribly concerning, and more evidence of it is, as you've said at the outset here, Mr. Trump does have in his hands the buttons and levers of power, one of which he has used to put Mr. Gorsuch, with the complicity of the U.S. Senate, has put Mr. Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. And had he not been on the Supreme Court yesterday or the day before, Liddell Lee would be alive today.
Well, in a way, I think it's probably a fitting irony that Gorsuch did. This was his first vote, because I thought he was a complete fraud, and he would never answer any of the real questions. And this is the lesson for us all, that elections have consequences. I don't know why we haven't learned that one.
Yes.
But maybe this will make us, all of us, a little more politically active. But just in closing, in terms of the issue that you care about, which is suffering a setback in Arkansas, clearly, what do we do? What's your exhortation to people out there in this country with compassion and concern who feel sort of overwhelmed and paralyzed by this hideous action on the part of the state of Arkansas?
Paralysis gives them power. Those who refuse to act on their own political instincts and their own political power and just simply throw their hands up, give power to the other side. We can't tolerate and we can't allow that. Death Penalty Focus will continue to try and organize, to try and disseminate information, to try and demonstrate against any executions, are they to take place, wherever they take place. And actually, we're having our annual awards dinner in a couple of weeks, and one of the primary honorees at our awards dinner is Senator Bernie Sanders, the only presidential candidate in this country who has been willing to make his his opposition to the death penalty a primary aspect of his candidacy. So I think there are those people out there. We just have to do our best to support them, to work for them, to do the work ourselves, to get involved, to do anything but throw up our hands in despair at the craziness, crazy turns that our country is taking.
You mean the Bernie Sanders, the character that the press said he's committed political suicide by insisting that he's not a Democrat, that he's a social Democrat or a Democratic socialist, and he doesn't have a prayer. Uh-huh. And they did not understand that the American public respect a man who sticks by his principles.
Absolutely. As unfortunately Ronald Reagan proved.
Right. Well, I thank you for joining us, Mike Farrell.
My pleasure, Ian.
Thank you.
Nice to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Mike Farrell, who's a political and social activist best known for his portrayal of B.J. Honeycutt in the TV series MASH and Jim Hansen in the NBC series Providence. He is the president of Death Penalty Focus, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the abolition of capital punishment through grassroots organizing, research, and the dissemination of political information about the death penalty and its alternatives. We're going to take a brief station break and back and go to Istanbul, Turkey, to look into the local reaction to the 102nd anniversary of the Armenian genocide.
This is my last song about myself, about my friends, found something else to sing. They wheeled out my casket, they said, boil it down your head. I said, oh shit, man, I ain't even dead. I won't be buried for a while.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Istanbul, Turkey, is Ronald Suni, who's a professor of social and political history and the director of the Eisenberg Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Michigan, as well as a professor emeritus of political science and history at the University of Chicago. He is the author of They Can Live in the Desert But Nowhere Else, A History of the Armenian Genocide. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ronald Suni.
Thank you for having me.
And Donald Trump, of course, is getting a lot of criticism today in his statement on the 102nd anniversary of the Armenian genocide for not using the word genocide, which none of his predecessors have used in any case. But the extra criticism comes from the extraordinary phone call that he made to President Erdogan, congratulating him for winning an election that is still being disputed by the OSCE and the Europeans, not to mention almost half of the population of Turkey, who happen to be the educated and urban half of the country. So you're in Turkey. Is there a sense of betrayal amongst the Turks who voted against Erdogan's power grab in this recent election?
First, let me say that there was one instance at which an American president, it was Ronald Reagan, who actually used the word genocide to describe the events of 1915. It's sort of forgotten, but it may be a footnote, but it did happen, and it's a nice thing to remember. But as you mentioned, it's true that in general, presidents of the United States, because of the alliance with Turkey, have refused to use that word. And going along basically with the Turkish government's point of view that this genocide never happened or it was a civil war or something else. The situation in Turkey today is a very odd one. They just had this election, as you mentioned. It was divided right down the middle, you know, 51.4%, 48.6%, despite the fact that all of the TV, all of the media was calling for the yes vote, pro-Erdogan vote, and very little chance for the other side to be heard. The other side, actually, many of the leading opponents of the yes vote were in jail. So it was a kind of lopsided thing, and yet it came so close. It was a very close victory for Edwin, as it turned out. People here, from what I've heard today, don't know what Donald Trump said. It hasn't really filtered down yet. They were more concerned that President Erdogan had made a somewhat conciliatory statement about not calling it a genocide, of course, but at least recognizing that Armenians had suffered 102 years ago. So it's an odd situation here. We had a small demonstration in the center of Istanbul, surrounded by police, of course. A small, even smaller counter-demonstration that seemed to be saying something odd about how the people who were commemorating the Armenian Genocide were tools of imperialism. It's a strange situation in this wonderful, beautiful city and this dynamic country that so many people don't know what happened 102 years ago, how indeed the Ottoman Empire ended and the Turkish Republic was founded.
But back to the congratulatory phone call from Donald Trump, congratulating Erdogan for winning, in quotes, the referendum. Have you had any sense of the impact that's had on those who voted against him? And it could be higher than the 48% that you mentioned, because the Europeans have suggested that there was some vote tampering. And as you mentioned, that wasn't a level playing field. What's your sense, though, of that? The idea that the American president had met shortly before that with the Egyptian dictator who took over in a military coup, General Sisi, that supposedly gave Assad some sense that maybe he can drop a few chemical warheads on his people because Donald Trump is transactional. And then Trump then turns around and congratulates Erdogan while the Europeans are disputing the results. And many people felt that undercut the moral authority of the United States and its democratic traditions. And so I'm just questioning you about what you are seeing there in Turkey in terms of the urban and educated people who, I imagine, feel a little bit undercut by our president.
I would say that after that, the referendum, the people I spoke to, and you can imagine who they would be, you know, students, faculty members, intellectuals of various kinds, were in not only despondent, they were in some kind of despair, because the sense was that the election had not been fair. It had been very biased, very much one-sided. And yet, it was not a very resounding victory for Erdogan. So it's not that people are totally dismayed, but what you find is a real fear about what the future holds, particularly among young people, a sense that it's unpredictable what might go next. And what, you know, this country holds for them, this new generation that's rising up. I'm an academic, and so I've been hanging out in academic settings and giving lectures and talking to people. And there, the sense is that here, Turkey had built up over the last couple of decades an incredible educational system, private universities that were being taught in English, high-class scholarship, recognition by what I would call the progressive Turkish and Kurdish intelligentsia of the Armenian Genocide, that such an event did occur and that people had to come to terms honestly, frankly, with their own past. All of those things seem at the moment on the verge of being destroyed as the Erdogan government, in fact, is arresting and dismissing academics of all kinds, jailing journalists, etc. On the Trump side, you know, why is this a surprise? Why is it a surprise that someone like Donald Trump would have sided with someone like General Sisi, who's, won power in a coup d'etat, is a kind of tyrant, has jailed his opposition, or would congratulate Erdogan on this dubious victory? We're going to see a lot more of that kind of thing. And as you sort of hinted in your question, the moral authority of the United States, which has also, you know, gone through a lot of shocks in the last 15 years, is really in tatters at the moment.
And again, I'm speaking with Ronald Suni, who is in Istanbul, Turkey. He is a professor of social and political history and the director of the Eisenberg Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Michigan, as well as a professor emeritus of political science and history at the University of Chicago. He's the author of They Can Live in the Desert But Nowhere Else, A History of the Armenian Genocide. So the other aspect, of course, of the connections between Erdogan and Trump are to do with business. I was just looking at a tweet the other day from Ivanka Trump congratulating or thanking President Erdogan for showing up at the opening of a Trump hotel, which a Turkish partner who's close to Erdogan is involved with. So is there any sense in Turkey that, I mean, let's face it, we've never had a president in the history of the United States, and this goes back to the Constitution where they put in the emoluments clause to prevent the profiting from the presidency. We've never had anybody in the presidency who's actually an active businessman. His sons and daughter are still running the company that he owns. He hasn't given it up. The brand has gone up in value. It's pretty hard not to see that even though a lot of people think his presidency is a disaster and it's going nowhere, on the other hand, the Trump brand has gone through the ceiling.
Yes, well, you used the word transactional. You know, this is a deal maker, and he's a person who's been very skillful, if not completely honest, in his business dealings. And you're probably going to see a lot more of that. He's obviously giving comfort to a lot of politicians, largely on the right, largely of the more authoritarian style in Europe. You know, people like Marine Le Pen, who did pretty well, though she came in second in yesterday's election in France, or for a while at least, Vladimir Putin, Erdogan, Sisi, etc. And those, the fact that he's more interested in a kind of strategic, instrumentalist, transactional relationship, you know, America first and what's good for America, rather than thinking, as other presidents have done, you know, Jimmy Carter and Barack Obama, most notably, about human rights, about democracy, those kinds of things. This is going to be a good era for the next year or so, as long as he's president, for those with this kind of populist, nationalist, authoritarian streak in their governing style.
But could it be deeper in a way that Donald Trump's father was a developer, a real estate developer, but he mostly built housing. And, of course, they got into trouble because of the public housing they were building. They didn't want to let African-Americans in. But Donald Trump discovered that the way to get rich is to target your real estate development for the super rich. And in many ways, he helped turn New York into a magnet for the global elite who have certainly showed up there. And Trump Tower is full of millionaires and billionaires and oligarchs of all stripes. A lot of them are kleptocrats. And, you know, they have restrictions on co-ops in New York, but no such problem with any Trump property. If you got the money to pay for it, you're in there and you're quite welcome. And it seems to me that that is also sort of translating into his attitude to foreign policy. There's nobody at the State Department to as a check and balance. And I remember when he first started his campaign, one of the first photo ops, he presented this Indonesian fellow who was his buddy saying, we're going to do great deals with Indonesia. Well, this guy was the bag man for General Prabowo, the guy that lost the election. And so that's the way I see this man, as somebody that is, in a way, in terms of his foreign policy, is still transacting the politics of kleptocracy.
It's very hard to easily write off Donald Trump because this is not simply, as you've indicated, an American problem or even a European problem. This is a global problem. Something fundamentally is going on in the world that's very different, that's more reminiscent, though it's not as bad as the 1930s. That is, if you go from Modi in India through the Middle East, the people we've mentioned, to Orban in Hungary, Kaczynski in Poland, Marine Le Pen and others, some who have been defeated, some who haven't been, Putin, etc. You have across the globe a phenomenon where people and certain leaders have turned against the more liberal globalization kinds of efforts back into a kind of isolationism. The building of walls is a good symbol of that. And Donald Trump is articulating that sort of more nationalism, more America first or Turkey first or whatever first, and an appeal to the kind of discontented peoples who have not done well in this neoliberal era. The irony is that Donald Trump, for all of his appeals to the Rust Belt, to the working class of Pennsylvania and Michigan and Ohio and Wisconsin, in fact, has created a government of billionaires, military men, and right-wing ideologues, none of whom, it seems to me, and I've been out of the country for a while, but I read carefully and listen carefully every day, and none of those people seem to have the immediate interest, except maybe to win the next election, of the sort of working class people and middle class people that put him in power.
Well, Ronald Sunni, just back to the 102nd anniversary of the Armenian Genocide, and you're there in Istanbul, Turkey. One of the aspects of it that historians don't often discuss, at least focus on, is the economic side, if you will, of the murder of 1.5 million Armenians and driving them into the desert, which you've, of course, written about in your book, They Can Live in the Desert But Nowhere Else, A History of the Armenian Genocide. It's worth noting that the Armenians were fairly prosperous, and all of their properties, all of their homes, all of their possessions, all of their bank accounts were stolen and expropriated. And this is not unlike what the Nazis did with the Jews in Europe. They took their properties, took their money, took their art. We're still having famous paintings being disputed to this day. So do you think that aspect of the plunder, that not only was this about such an extraordinary inhumanity in terms of genocide, but was also there was this other motive, or at least perhaps a bonus, if you will, of economic plunder?
Absolutely, yes. And don't forget that, you know, white Americans, European Americans did the same thing with Native Americans, you know, appropriating property and benefiting from the expansion across the continent. Karl Marx once remarked that, you know, capitalism was built on the primitive accumulation of capital. Well, he was talking about England and the enclosure movement, the driving of peasants off the land, the consolidation under the hands of large landowners. Well, in some places, like the late Ottoman Empire, you had what I would call the most primitive accumulation of capital. What they did was murder as many as they could or drive them into the desert and just take all the stuff and replace a largely Christian Greek and Armenian and also Jewish bourgeoisie with the more native Muslim bourgeoisie. The properties were taken and then redistributed among people who were favored by the Ottoman government and then the successor government, the early government of the Turkish Republic. The origins of the Armenian Genocide itself are very complicated, but certainly you've put your finger on one thing. There was a very great competition for land in Anatolia. Anatolia is basically the peninsula on which the modern Turkish Republic is built. There was a real competition between Kurds and Turks, Armenians, Assyrians, and others, particularly in eastern Anatolia, Armenians being driven off the land or their land confiscated, etc. And the genocide itself was in one disastrous movement, the elimination of one of those chief competitors. And so what was historically Armenia, if you go back centuries, is now Kurdistan. It's now largely occupied by the Kurdish people, who, by the way, to their credit, have officially and through their representatives recognized the genocide and in some ways apologized for the genocide. They see themselves now as victims, too, of the Turkish state. But that economic base to what occurred in 1915 was certainly powerful. It's not the only thing. There were international considerations. There was fear that by the Ottoman government that the Armenians were too close to the Russians, and Turkey and Russia were at war at the time. There were what I call affective dispositions, emotional constructions of the Armenians as a subversive, untrustworthy, deceptive group that had to be eliminated in order to make the empire safe. So there are a lot of complicated things, but you could, I think your point is a very good one, that underneath many of these things were economic competition for limited resources, namely land.
Well, just in the last minute, Ronald Sunni, why is it that the State of Israel and the Jewish diaspora have been so much more successful in terms of keeping the memory of the Holocaust alive and making people aware of what the Nazis did, whereas the Armenians have been much less successful? Certainly they haven't been able to convince the Turkish government to admit to what happened. What do you think the explanation for that is?
That's a complicated question with a complicated answer. The Holocaust, the Judaicide by the Nazis, occurred in Europe. It was much more visible. It occurred in a period of mass media. The Nazis were totally defeated by the Allies and eventually had to come to terms with what they had done and recognize it. And one must give credit to the Germans in particular that they very fruitfully and very effectively, with much pain and difficulty, did recognize what had occurred during the Second World War and before. The Ottoman Empire was defeated, but it very quickly was replaced by the Turkish Republic, which wasn't defeated, which eliminated some of the peoples, like the Greeks, by population exchange, etc., and created a new country here in a war of liberation against foreign invasions and others. And so it was immediately brought into the family of nations without any need to recognize what had happened or what occurred before that republic was formed. And it occurred a long time ago. The people who were destroyed, those who immigrated, those who were deported, like the Armenians, were so traumatized that it took a generation before they themselves clearly articulated to themselves and to the world what had happened.
Well, Ronald Sunni, I thank you very much for joining us from Istanbul. And again, I've been speaking with Ronald Sunni, who's a professor of social and political history and the director of the Eisenberg Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Michigan, as well as a professor emeritus of political science and history at the University of Chicago. He's the author of They Can Live in the Desert But Nowhere Else, A History of the Armenian Genocide. And he joined us from Istanbul, Turkey. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with a Turkish scholar who is considered the Sherlock Holmes of the Armenian Genocide. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Tana Akçam, who holds the Chair of Armenian Genocide Studies at Clark University and is the author of many books, including The Young Turks, Crime Against Humanity. His latest book is The Spirit of the Laws. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tana Akçam.
Oh, thank you very much.
Well, Tana, you have been described as the Sherlock Holmes of the Armenian Genocide, and I believe that you unearthed an original telegram of the trials of the Young Turks, which is considered the smoking gun. As we know, the Turkish government has denied the genocide took place, and of course, today President Trump did not use the word genocide in recognizing the 102nd anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. So describe what you found and why it is the smoking gun.
Let me read the telegram, then we decide together what how should we qualify this telegram? It is sent on July 4th, 1915, and it says, "Are the Armenians who were deported from there being liquidated? Are the troublesome individuals whom you have reported as having been exiled and expelled being eliminated or merely sent off and deported? Please report back honestly." So the telegram in question was sent with the aim of coordinating the elimination, the killing process. And the person who sent this telegram was the head of special organization. This was established for the purpose of extermination of Armenians, and we know this from several sources. And now, and this telegram that I read is also, I discovered, on an Ottoman letterhead. This means the official Interior Ministry's letterhead, and this telegram, and there is also another very important information. On this telegram, there is a coding system, 4-digit numbers, codes for each words or endings, and I compare this with the existing documents in the Ottoman archive. It is exactly the same coding system. So there is no way exit for Turkish government.
So, but who was the telegram sent to? It was sent from the headquarters checking on what was happening in the field and basically saying, have you killed them all? That's...
Yes.
Right.
And the person who telegram was sent, his name was Nazım, and he was the field operator in another province. I will call these provinces so that the listener might recognize them. One is Erzurum. This is the headquarters of special organization, from where Bahattin Şakir, the chief of Teşkilat-ı Mahsusa, the chief of special organization, was sending this telegram, and to the city of Elazığ. This is where this operator was acting to kill the Armenians. And here is the another crucial information for the readers, listeners, I'm sorry. There was a trial in 1920 in Istanbul military court-martial. And these both individual that I named, Bahattin Şakir and the field operator Nazım, they were sentenced to death penalty in absentia, especially because of this telegram also.
And these were the trials of the so-called Young Turks, right?
Yes, so, these were Young Turks tribunals set up 1919.
Right, and that's, of course, always been something of an historical irony, hasn't it, been that there was actual trials after the Armenian genocide of the Young Turks, which by definition had to acknowledge that a genocide had taken place because they put them on trial for those very crimes. But then subsequent to those crimes and those trials, the Turkish government has denied such a genocide took place.
Yes, and with one more addition, also they hide or destroyed all these court materials. We didn't know whereabouts of these all materials that came to light during these tribunals.
Well, specifically, the material that you found, from what I understand, is that they were shipped, 24 boxes of these court records were shipped to England for safekeeping, and they were kept there by a bishop, and then later they were taken to France, and then later to Jerusalem, where they remained until the 1930s. And so tell us about the detective work you did in uncovering these records and this historical documentation proving that the Armenian Genocide took place.
In order to make it more clearer, we have to know that these documents were given by the presiding judge of the military court to Armenian Patriarch. Armenian Patriarch in Istanbul was representing the Armenians during these trials, and they had the legal right to have access to these materials. This is how they got a hand on these materials. So then how I found these? we knew already, those scholars in the field, we knew that these materials were in Jerusalem, Armenian Patriarch. And I also personally know that these materials were filmed by a priest, Grigor Gergerian, and who deceased, he passed away in New York. And I tried to get access to this private archive several times. Finally, 2015, the nephew of the priest allowed me to see the materials.
And again, I'm speaking with Tana Akçam, who holds the chair of Armenian Genocide Studies at Clark University and is the author of many books, including The Young Turks, Crime Against Humanity, and his latest book is The Spirit of the Laws. So since you've been labeled the Sherlock Holmes of the Armenian genocide, you're actually a Turkish citizen, right? You're not an Armenian.
I am Turkish citizen, yes.
Right. So I take it you must not be particularly popular, because there's been this, as we mentioned, this peculiar denial on the part of successive Turkish governments. I understand that Erdogan made a reasonably conciliatory statement today, but still rejects the idea of genocide.
I mean, this was the case in early years. I think it has changed now. I don't like to talk about myself, but even among the government circles, I'm a respected scholar now. I earned my status in Turkish society. Today, whatever I say, it is taken seriously. I give you one example. Recently, for my research, I was in Istanbul, and I met with a very top official of Turkish Foreign Ministry. And he honestly told me, it was a kind of a private gathering, he told me that he respects me and they follow me very seriously, regardless whether they agree with my position or not.
So why do they maintain this position of denial?
There are three major reasons. One is materials. Of course, if they accept any historic wrongdoing, they have to pay reparations. They don't want to do that. And the second important reason is the moral aspect of it. If they accept the genocide, they might accept also some founding members of Turkish Republic were either thieves or murderers during this genocidal process, because Turkish state was established by the party that organized the Armenian genocide. And the third reason, I call it Pinocchio effect. You know, the more you lie, the longer your nose. And it's difficult, of course, to make reverse all these lies over 100 years.
So what will be done to settle this? It's not going away, is it, clearly?
It is not going to away because of the growing Turkish civil society. Especially there is a growing civil society in Turkey after Hrant Dink's assassination, the Armenian journalist in Istanbul. And there is now a growing awareness in Turkey, and it won't go away. And the only reasonable, and it damages Turkey, and the only reasonable solution is Turkey should start talking with Armenian government and Armenian diaspora, as Germany did after Second World War.
But most observers and scholars of Turkey feel that this recent referendum is likely to make Turkey more and more authoritarian, less democratic, and that is the, in fact, intention of Erdogan. So if it becomes more repressive, quite often in repressive regimes, history is the first victim.
I kindly disagree with that view. I know the nine or no from the referendum was not a good result, but believe me, this 51 yes is equal as a big no, because they rigged the election, this is number one, and number two, they know that it is the beginning of end of the AKP government, especially Tayyip Erdogan. I don't think that he could hold, it can hold the power in coming 2, 3, 4 years. I think there will be a growing opposition, and I know from the psychology of these opposition in Turkey, they have the feeling of the victory now. It will change. This is my hope, at least.
So you think that in the defeat, is this similar to what's happening with the Democrats in this country? The Democrats were pretty useless, but now they seem to be getting their act together because they're so appalled at Donald Trump. Is that likely to, is that what you're saying? That
it's a very interesting comparison. Yes, it's true. I agree kind of with it. And there is now a growing opposition in this country. And if Democrats would not really do more, they would lose this opposition, this growing grassroots movement. And this is what we're experiencing in Turkey. Exactly, yes.
So what is then your sense about Donald Trump? I mean, he congratulated Erdogan.
Well, to be honest with you, I don't see basic difference between Obama and Trump regarding the foreign policy. I don't think that the American policy based on easily on the presidents and their preferences. There is a long-range policy of American state, and it does not change so easily. And I personally, I mean, my expectation is there won't be a big change regarding the Middle East. They will continue whatever Pentagon's desire for the Middle East is.
So in other words, as long as they need the Incirlik Air Force Base and as long as they want Turkey to be in NATO, those concerns will trump human rights and democratic principles.
Don't forget, please. We had a military coup d'etat 1980, and Jimmy Carter was on the power, the most human rights advocate president here in the United States. He was one of the best supporters of Turkish military regime in Turkey. So whether it's Democrat or Republicans here in Washington, it won't change much in the Middle East. I learned, to be honest, I have to tell the listener that there is a difference between Republicans and Democrats when I came to the United States.
Just clarify that in the last minute, if you will.
Regarding the foreign policy, I grew up in Turkey. My socialization was in Turkey. I was very active in students' movement. I'm coming from a progressive family. And for us, the American policy in the Middle East, a constant, steady policy, this means supporting Turkish authoritarian military regimes in Turkey. It hasn't changed whether Democrats and Republicans was on power. And for me, they didn't make any difference. I learned here when I came to United States that the Republicans and Democrats make only a difference regarding the domestic policies, not much in foreign policy, though.
Well, Taner Akçam, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I thank you for having me on program.
And again, I've been speaking with Taner Akçam, who holds the chair of Armenian Genocide Studies at Clark University and is the author of many books, including The Young Turks, Crime Against Humanity, and his latest book is The Spirit of the Laws.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.